The Tommy Schnurmecker Show on Montreal's news talk leader, CJAD 800.
His death sparked a right-to-life controversy across the country in what many people are calling an act of slow euthanasia at the hands of his doctors, even though, of course, that is illegal right now in Canada. Kolendra Mayandi, Joshua, as his friends call him, passed away a week ago at Brampton Hospital, 3 weeks after doctors reportedly stopped giving him food and water to speed up his death because they believed he wouldn't recover anyway from brain damage brought on by a heart attack. What really happened, and what can this story teach us about palliative care and end-of-life decisions to help us figure that out? We're speaking to Derek Miedema of the Institute of Marriage and Family Canada. Good morning. Welcome to CJD.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So what happened with this man? Well, after he had the heart attack and he stopped breathing, there was severe brain damage. He was in intensive care, but he was making significant progress. I'm told that he was speaking a few words, single words at a time. He could eat a little bit. He recognized family and friends. Why are we even discussing removal of a feeding tube and water?
Well, that's the question that's before us, and I should clarify, he was granted water but no food. It was the hospital's decision. I don't know entirely why they decided this. I wasn't able to get a response from the hospital, but they decided to remove all his feeding tubes, an IV tube, a tube through his nose. That's the way he was getting any nutrition. They decided to remove both of those. His family fought it. The hospital continued. And when
to remove nutrition, so that means he's not eating anything at all. He's getting water, but not eating anything at all.
He's only getting water, no food at all.
No food at all. No. So they're starving him to death.
Yes, and at some point, because the family protested this, there were people who were able to give him some form of nutrition. From what I understand, it was a thickened glucosey solution that they could give him by mouth. But there wasn't any, you know, nothing that gave him the nutrition that he needed to be able to survive.
Now, also in the case, since he wasn't able to make any decisions for himself, he didn't have a living will, they needed to appoint what they call an SDM, a substitute decision maker. A member of his family from Sri Lanka wanted to be a substitute decision maker, and he was rejected by the board.
Yes.
And then they appointed another friend of his only on condition that he agree to accept the removal of nutrition tubes. Is that legal? In other words, that you can only make the decisions for him provided you agree to let us starve him to death?
Well, it is in fact legal, and I should clarify, this is the Consent and Capacity Board of Ontario, so this is, as far as I know, limited to Ontario, but that Consent and Capacity Board is able, according to Ontario law, to make such a condition.
So what can we learn from this for people who are worried about end-of-life decisions? They don't want to live in excruciating pain, and they have a living will and a mandate. How sure can they be of what's going to happen to them when they get to the hospital?
Well, I think it's very important to be able to spell out your desires for end-of-life care. And it's very important also that you have someone with you who can advocate for you. Not just in this case, but if you're able to appoint a substitute decision maker, a power of attorney for personal care in other jurisdictions, that's a very important step to make so that you have someone who knows you, who knows what you want, who can then speak on your behalf.
Now, who gets the final word, the doctor or the family member who has that that mandate or power of attorney or the decision-making capacity?
Well, clearly in this case, and in another one in Toronto that I footnoted in my article, clearly in these cases, it's been the hospital, it's been the doctors who override the substitute decision maker. So that's a very troubling development, certainly, and that leads me to say that this clearly is, if everything happened as has been described to me, it clearly is a case where Mr. Mayandi was not dying as a result of his heart attack. He was severely, he had severe brain damage. He wasn't dying. That it appears that it was the hospital's decision to give him a lack of food that he died by starvation. So they didn't provide him the care he needed to live well and to die well naturally. They took away care that led him to die, that hastened his death.
Now, when someone is in a coma, there are cases when someone is in a coma, they never recover from the coma. They're described as being in a vegetative state, and they never recover. Then there are cases where they do recover. How can you, as a citizen hoping that'll never happen to, but if it does, how can you say, if I go into a coma, let me go or keep me going for a week or 2 weeks? You don't know what the outcome is going to be in a coma.
Well, that's part of the difficulty here. As we see in this case, you can lay out those desires. You can lay that out very clearly in writing to make that known, to make those desires known. But then the question still becomes, is the hospital, are the doctors going to follow those? So it is possible to write an advance directive that you would lay out, if this happens to me, I want this to happen. But the other difficulty in that is none of us can know exactly what's going to happen, when it's going to happen. And I, as a, you know, as a 38-year-old male, I can't right now write and say that when I'm 70 and I have a heart attack, this is how I'm going to feel. That will change over the course of my life. So if we write something like that for end-of-life care, we need to be consistently updating it as we grow older and as our opinions of that care might change.
What is the view of a hospital when it comes to these mandates? I mean, do they pick and choose what part they're going to listen to and what part they won't?
Well, again, I couldn't get a response from the hospital. They cited patient confidentiality, and I understand that. But there are questions that very much need to be answered here. If it is a case that the hospital in Brampton, sped this man's death via starvation, that's a huge, that's a violation of Canadian law, and that needs to be addressed.
Truth be told, Derek, isn't it true that this is happening all the time, not just in this Toronto hospital, all over the place? And the real reason for it, that it's very, very expensive, that all these hospitals are in limited budget. They feel if this guy's going to die anyway, they just don't want to keep him there that long.
Well, I guess I would cite a letter to the editor I read in a paper this morning that makes just that case. And I think, I can't say in particular to the hospital that we're dealing with in this case of Mr. Miandy, but that is a real issue in cases like this.
Now,
you know, to those who say we need to legalize this, we need to legalize assisted suicide and euthanasia because it's already happening, look at this case. Look at this case, and is this what we want to happen? Is this what we want to roll out more and more across the country to happen to more and more people?
Speaking of euthanasia, the Killing Commission having its meetings here in Quebec. If they were to go ahead with that, and according to polls, many, many polls, three-quarters of the population in Quebec can't wait. They love the idea of euthanasia. In addition to cases like this, what else could we see if once it becomes legal and a doctor is allowed legally to kill a patient?
Well, I have a study that was released by the Canadian Medical Association Journal in June of this year, and they looked at 208 deaths involving assisted suicide and euthanasia. Let me see, most of those patients were over 80 years of age. So I think a very real possibility. If there's a situation, for example, where there's a large inheritance and children or a caregiver want to have access to that inheritance, they could have another option to kill their loved one and gain the inheritance. And if it's legal, there would be no way to prosecute that. So we open the door to elder abuse. We open the door to people with disabilities, with chronic illness, not only with terminal illness, but we open the door for people with cerebral palsy. We open the door for people with lifelong chronic illness that they need to justify why they can exist every day of their life because it's very expensive for them to live. So this is a reality that I don't think we should foist upon those who want to continue to live. I don't think we should foist upon them the demand that they justify why they should be able to continue to live.
What's your response to people who say they want to decide, they didn't decide when they were born, but they want to decide when they died, that it's totally up to them, it's their business, they don't want the government or any religious authority telling them when they can die?
Well, I'd say this. The law that Francine Lalonde attempted to pass in the House of Commons, that law and laws in Washington and Oregon, what they do is they protect the doctors from prosecution if they kill you. This case of Mr. Miandy, the case that I referenced in my article in Toronto, two cases where individuals, family members, substitution decision makers all wanted to choose to live, and the doctors chose for them to die. And so in these two cases, they illustrate that in many, many, many cases where assisted suicide or euthanasia are involved, choice for the individual is a lie. What happens is it's a freer choice for the doctors because they don't have to risk being prosecuted.
Derek Miedema of the Institute of Marriage and the Family Canada. If you have any questions or comments for him, you can join the conversation, 514-790-0991. You're listening to Tommy Schneermacher on CJAD. We're discussing end-of-life issues and palliative care, and lots of discussion about that, especially with that panel roving around the province. On the line with us, Derek Miedema of the Institute of Marriage and Family Canada. You mentioned that a lot of this legislation, Francine Lalonde legislation that didn't get anywhere, basically that this legislation is there to protect doctors from prosecution. If we have this level, if we had euthanasia legalized, give me some examples of what other power it might give the doctor, a power that they don't have now.
Well, it would give the currently doctors have lots of options in terms of end-of-life care. But what it would give the doctors the right to do would be to give you right now what it would give doctors the option to do was to use any means to hasten death, to quicken your death. So they could give you pills that would kill you. They could potentially give you an injection. They could kill that could kill you. They could choose, as we've seen in this cases, to refuse to give you care.
And they could do this even if you didn't ask for it.
Well, that might not necessarily be a part of the law, but in most cases where it's been legalized, that happens. Many, many people in Belgium, many, many people in the Netherlands have been killed without their explicit request.
514-790-0991, Star Talk, text your comment to 514-800. You said, Derek, that most of these laws are there to protect doctors from prosecution. I mean, right now, I've never heard of any cases of doctors being prosecuted for hastening the end of the life of a patient.
Well, that's also, you know, that's also the question now as to how well the law is being applied. It's not only a question in terms of the happening and legalization of euthanasia that we need to change the law. It's also a question of how true to the law do we apply the law. We can choose, Quebec could choose, and this has been hinted at by the chair of the commission, Quebec could choose to just pretend the law isn't on the books. And then effectively it becomes legalized. The fact that no doctors are tried is also a case of how the law is being applied.
Well, so doesn't it mean that we're heading there no matter what?
No, I would not at all say that we're heading there no matter what. This is a question that needs to be discussed. This is a debate that needs to happen. But we have all sorts of palliative care and cancer care doctors coming before the commission speaking out strongly against euthanasia because they have experience with patients in palliative care and end-of-life care, and they know what this will do to their care. It has consequences for doctors, too. We have doctors who are working in palliative care who are trained to treat people and trained to help people as they come close to death. They're not out there hankering for a cure, doing extraordinary measures to keep a person alive. And now we're going to put those people in a position to have the ability to kill and in the position to give in to a patient's request to die when they know there are all sorts of ways to continue to treat that person spiritually, emotionally, physically, mentally, that can help them continue to live and recover from that desire to die.
514-790-0991, Star Talk. Text your questions, your comments to 514-800. Shireen from Ganawaki's on the line, Carol from Verdun. We'll get to your calls in a second. My guest, Derek Miedema of the Institute of Marriage and Family Canada. You're listening to Tommy Schneermacher on CJAD.